ready to hear argument now in the case of Varner against Monahan. Mr. McLeese.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Richard McLeese, and I represent the petitioner appellant in this case, Herbert Varner. As Your Honors are aware, this is a habeas case that concerns the federal constitutional constraints on a state's power to commit civilly, involuntarily, and indefinitely an individual on the ground that, A, due to a mental disorder, his ability to control his behavior is significantly impaired, and B, as a result of that impairment, he poses a significant risk that if he is not deprived of his freedom, he will commit sex offenses against other people. In our brief, Your Honors, we've raised two constitutional challenges. One concerns substantive due process, the other concerns equal protection. This morning, subject, of course, to the wishes of the Court, I intend to focus on the second of these constitutional challenges.
I do have a question.
Yes.
Because it wasn't completely clear to me what relief you're seeking. Are you simply asking for a new trial in which the jury is given the lack of control instruction? Is that what you're...
Yes, Your Honor, that would be the that would be the ultimate relief that I would anticipate would be awarded here if the Court were to agree with our position. That is, the error here, in our view, is that the jurors were never required to make a lack of control determination.
Are there any double jeopardy issues at play in this type of civil commitment?
Not that I'm aware of, and I know that the Illinois courts, for example, have repeatedly reversed, vacated, and sent back cases for new commitment hearings on the basis that a determination that was necessary was not made. The Supreme Court, in dealing with various challenges that are based on rights that are available in the criminal context, double jeopardy, ex post facto, and so forth, has repeatedly rejected such challenges on the ground that, oh, this is not a criminal proceeding, this is a civil proceeding, the main considerations of which are incapacitation and treatment.
Mr. McLeese, what do we make of the volitional capacity language in the jury instructions? I mean, isn't that the same thing as asking the jury to establish that the defendant lacked the ability to control his behavior?
Your Honor, I don't think it's the same thing, and I think the only way to really analyze this is to break it down and ask what questions the jurors have to ask and who has the burden of proof as to those questions. In our opening brief, Your Honor, I posed three hypotheticals in which...
Right. You're talking about those hypotheticals at 39 and 40?
Yes, Judge, 37 and following. And the problem...
Do they address the volitional capacity language in the jury instructions? In other words, if each of the jurors had considered the defendant's volitional capacity, would their analysis properly support a decision under Crane?
Well, there are a few different aspects to Your Honor's question. If I think what you're asking is the type of lack of control determination that I am submitting is constitutionally necessary, is it implicit in the determination that the jurors had to make with these instructions? And I submit that it was not, Your Honor, and the reason why is because the jury instructions as given for the Sexual Violent Predators Act permit commitment on the basis of A, finding a predisposition based upon a certain type of disorder, B, a prior sexual offense, and then C, some sort of substantial probability that if the person's not committed, they may commit further offenses in the future. The problem with that model, Your Honor, is that a person could conclude that the requisite substantial probability was provided simply on the basis of a predisposition, say pedophilia, and the prior offense, without ever considering, much less resolving, the question of whether the individual presently has the ability to control his behavior. And what I tried to point out in those hypotheticals is, as Your Honor is aware, the one way of conceiving of the burden of persuasion is that it is the risk of non-persuasion. As the instructions are given pursuant to the Sexually Violent Persons Act, the state can obtain commitment without jurors ever having to consider, much less resolve, the question whether the individual presently has significant difficulty controlling his sexual behavior. And so under these circumstances, it's in effect the defendant, or not the defendant, I'm so used to that language, but the individual who needs to prove to the juror's satisfaction, oh, I do have the ability. And if the jurors go back, as jurors often do, and say, you know what, I don't know if this person has the ability to control his behavior or not, but I believe that under the instructions given, commitment is appropriate here. The way that these instructions were given here, that juror votes in favor of commitment. However, if, as we submit, and as the Illinois Supreme Court said in Masterson, which is the case that gives rise to our equal protection claim, if the juror must additionally make a determination that the individual has serious difficulty controlling his behavior in order to commit that individual, then a juror back in the jury room who says, you know what, I really don't know whether this person ultimately has serious difficulty at this point or not, that juror, if instructed specifically on that element, comes back and votes against commitment, because there it's clear that the state has the burden of persuasion, or in other words, the risk of non-persuasion on that issue. And so if you have a juror, a decision maker, who's not persuaded one way or the other, then it's the party that bears the burden of persuasion on the issue that loses. And that's what's really critical here, is who has the burden of persuasion, who has the risk of non-persuasion on this lack of control issue, which, if I've addressed Your Honor's question, leads into the equal protection issue, because on the very same day, the Illinois Supreme Court read Crane.
And how, by the way, has the burden of persuasion issue been clearly resolved by the Supreme Court?
Your Honor?
Since this is a collateral attack under the AEDPA, we can resolve. We can insist that state courts follow rules clearly established by the Supreme Court, but any novel rules are beyond our
Well, Your Honor, I think purchase. That's, I think that's partially correct, but not entirely correct. I think that that is correct insofar as a state court has decided the issue on the merits. However, whereas here, where you have the equal protection claim that does not involve a state court decision on the merit, as this court made clear, and I believe it's the Muth case, M-U-T-H, that's...
I was asking about the burden of persuasion.
Well, the burden of persuasion, Your Honor, what I'm trying to focus on is the equal protection issue, because I think it's the... I think that the equal...
Is there some place where the Supreme Court clearly decided who bears the burden?
Well, I think the Supreme Court has clearly decided in Crane that...
Almost nothing in Crane is clear.
Well,
that's why
I think it
several
has,
of the justices were upset.
Right.
They complained that the majority opinion in Crane was a kind of fuzzy-wuzzy, we-know-it-when-we-see-it approach, and they wanted a clear rule, but that's why they were writing separately.
Right, I understand. But I think that this, to the extent that something is made clear there, it is that the state cannot obtain involuntary commitment in this context without there being demonstrated serious difficulty in controlling behavior.
So the answer is the Supreme Court has not clearly allocated the burden between the parties.
Well,
it suggested something that might have to be shown, but it didn't say
that. That's correct, Your Honor, but our equal protection argument, Your Honor, does not stand or fall on that point. Because if we are correct, Your Honors, that the Illinois Supreme Court, in allocating the burden of proof on that issue to the state with so-called SDPs, sexually dangerous persons, but then functionally allocating that burden to the defendant in SVPs, SVPA, under the SVPA, that is the basis for our equal protection argument, Judge. And so no matter where our equal protection argument would say you can't allocate the burden one way in one case and the other way in the other case.
And which Supreme Court decision clearly established that rule?
You're referring to the United States Supreme Court?
Yeah.
I'm not saying that. Well, I'm saying the United States Supreme Court, Your Honor, has clearly established the need for equal protection. And with respect to
that's obviously not the degree of specificity required for this case.
No, but, Judge, respectfully, 2254 and the standards that apply there do not apply to our equal protection argument because the state court did not decide that issue on the merit. And this court in the...
Of course, that's what leads to the argument that it's been forfeited because it wasn't presented either.
Yes, which the district court immediately and in our view correctly dispatched because it was presented at the first available opportunity because the argument only could have come about, could only have been made once the Illinois Supreme Court made two diametrically opposed decisions on the same day. And it was that gave rise to the equal protection argument. The individual tried to make that argument in a petition for rehearing and at the first available opportunity, and it was rejected. And that's why the district judge here properly said, look, this individual raised this issue at the first available time. You can't say that it's procedurally defaulted when they did that because it's the Illinois Supreme Court that acted in issuing contradictory decisions that gives rise to the equal protection problem. And it's as to that issue, Judge, that you do not sit even under the AEDPA, because you do not sit on that issue in deference to the Illinois court, because 2254 does not apply in that context.
Counsel, I'm not asking about deference or anything like that. I was asking the clearly established question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is your position that all of 2254D is irrelevant?
Judge, if you look at the Muth case, which is the decision of this circuit, yes, those standards of review, and it's from those standards of review that one looks for clearly established Supreme Court rules, those standards of review come into play only if there has been a state court decision on the merits. If there has not, they are inapplicable. I agree that those standards are applicable to our first claim, substantive due process, and in all candor, that's part of the reason why I'm focusing my argument today on the equal protection argument, because we are not bound by those standards of review on the equal protection issue. I see that I'm entering into my time for rebuttal. Unless Your Honors have any other further questions right now, I will reserve my remaining time.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McLeese. Ms. Griffin.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Colleen Griffin with the Illinois Attorney General's Office on behalf of the respondent. First, I'd like to just briefly address some of the points made by petitioner about the due process claim. In Illinois, the Sexually Violent Persons Act requires proof of a conviction of a sexually violent offense, a specific definition of mental disorder, and a defined burden regarding the likelihood of future offenses related to the mental problem. And that third factor comes from the definition of sexually violent persons and mental disorder as defined in the Act.
Let me just ask you this. Is there any legislative history that would explain why the legislature included the definition of mental disorder in the Sexually Violent Persons Act but not in the Sexually Dangerous Persons Act?
I don't believe there's any legislative history on it. However, the Sexually Dangerous Persons Act was enacted in 1938, and the Sexually Violent Persons Act was enacted in 1998, so I don't know if it was just an oversight then, or however, they did remedy that in the People versus Masterson case. The requirements of Crane that there be proof of a serious difficulty in controlling behavior is explicit in the definitions of both the Sexually Violent Persons Act and the sexually violent person and the mental disorder, where they talk about a lack of or a condition that a capacity that predisposes a person to engage in acts of sexual violence, and that mental condition makes it substantially probable that the person will engage in acts of sexual violence. When petitioner is referring to his three-juror situation, if those findings are made, those problems do not exist. The petitioner has no burden of proof. The state has met its burden when these showings are made. Regarding the equal protection claim, first, it's the respondent's position that this claim is procedurally defaulted. Petitioner raised a claim in the Illinois Appellate Court that sexually violent persons are treated worse under the Sexually Violent Persons Act than under the Sexually Dangerous Persons Act, that in effect people being committed under the Sexually Dangerous Persons Act are afforded more protections. The petitioner abandoned this claim before the Illinois Supreme Court. While the district court disagreed and found that the issue could not be raised until the Masterson decision had been issued on the same day as Varner, Masterson did not create an equal protection issue. It just provided another fact to support petitioner's claim that more was granted to petitioners under the Sexually Dangerous Persons Act. So the respondent disagrees with the district court that this claim was not procedurally defaulted. And if this court decides to go to the equal protection claim, Masterson simply did not give persons under the Sexually Dangerous Persons Act anything that was not provided under the Sexually Violent Persons Act. Masterson specifically stated that, unlike the Sexually Violent Persons Act, the Sexually Dangerous Persons Act did not expressly address the probability or likelihood that the subject of the proceeding would engage in sexual offenses in the future, and that was because the Sexually Dangerous Persons Act did not have the definition of mental disorder. So the court in Masterson found that the legislator had not meant for that to be, so they would read the definition of mental disorder from the Sexually Violent Persons Act into the Sexually Dangerous Persons Act. Petitioner believes that there's an additional finding that Masterson said had to be made just because of the additional language they included in the definition of and results in serious difficulty controlling behavior. However, again, those findings already have to be made under the Sexually Violent Persons Act. It's just different language that they used in Masterson because of the Crane decision. That was the language used in Crane, so they added it to the definition. However, because it's already included in the definition under the Sexually Violent Persons Act, it did not give the petitioner the petitioner anything under the Sexually Dangerous Persons Act that he did not have under the Sexually Violent Persons Act. If there's no questions, the respondent would ask this court to affirm the decision of the district court here. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, counsel. Anything further, Mr. McLeese?
As your honors are aware, when you are construing a statute, it is a commonplace of statutory construction that no language should be regarded as mere surplusage, and that every word should be given meaning. The clearest support for our proposition that this additional language that the Illinois Supreme Court included in Masterson, that it has some additional meaning and requires something else, is the very fact that they included it. What they were doing here was, in effect, rewriting the statute the way that they thought that it would be written if it were written today. If they, as the state claims, thought that the statutory language in the SVPA was constitutionally sufficient in their view, they would not have gone on and said that they were, quote, augmenting that language. Augment is their word at page 749 of the Northeast Second Volume, with the standard that appears to emerge from Crane. If that language were sufficient, the SVPA language, they would have simply relied upon that language. Once again, Your Honors, that gets to our equal protection issue. The point is that what the Illinois Supreme Court here did on that day is no more rational, no less arbitrary than if they had said, all right, if your name begins, your last name begins with the first letter that's in the first half of the alphabet, like Mr. Masterson, in order for you to be committed, you have to show additionally, state, that there is significant difficulty controlling behavior. But, Mr. Varner, if your name begins in the last half of the alphabet, such a showing need not be made. It is that, issuing two diametrically opposed decisions in the same day that read and implement Crane differently, that gives rise to the equal protection claim. Your Honor, I happened to read the other day a statement that...
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case will be taken under advisement. And Mr. McLeese, we want to thank you for accepting the appointment of the court and the assistance you've been both to your client and the court.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much.